I will always be hoping, hoping you will always be holding, holding my heart in your hand. I will understand, I will understand someday, one day. You will understand always, always from now until then. When it will be right, I don't know. What it will be like, I don't know. We live in hope of deliverance from the darkness that surrounds us. Hope of deliverance, hope of deliverance, hope of deliverance from the darkness that surrounds us.
This is podcast 385, entitled Jack Be Nimble, Not. And you've just heard an excerpt from Paul McCartney's 1992, I think it was, single Hope of Deliverance, with its brilliant MTV video that came out, a powerful song about the possibility in the middle of, or at the end of, the frayed end of one's rope of tragic loss, discomfort, despair, and unresolved experience, which you may say, oh, well, that's just occasional. But it's not. It's not occasional. It's almost universal, and almost everybody has it, and almost everybody is dealing with it, with exceptions, almost all the time, with exceptions. But the universality of pain is something that the world backpedals on. It doesn't want to hear, but it's simply true, because I know it's true. I've been living with and helping and attempting to help people for years and years and years on this very question. Now, what got me going on this, in addition to this remarkable song that came to me in the middle of the night, Hope of Deliverance by Paul McCartney, is a number of denominational communications recently in my own denomination, in which dioceses, which have merged because of attrition and decline in numbers, that have merged to sort of to have less expenses, one bishop for two dioceses, or one diocesan headquarters for two, or dioceses that have sold their camps, that have been around for 100 years, but have sold their camps for needed income equity, or have sold bishops' houses or diocesan headquarters, or have combined resources, or parishes, many, many parishes that are merging now because they cannot exist independently any longer. And what the constant sort of cliche word is, we have done this, we have merged resources, or we have unloaded long-term assets that are doing nothing for us, like certain real estate or parish halls or something like real estate, and in hopes of becoming more nimble. That's the word I call it, more nimble in reaching the needs of the community around us. If we don't have these stultifying assets, which are loading us down with debt and are not giving us financial resources back, let's get rid of them, sell them, rent them, however, so that we can now be more nimble, which is really a way of saying, it's a way of covering over loss. Nimble. Nimble means kind of light on our feet, because in place of two employees, we'll have one. In place of one diocesan budget, we'll have two, that is, we'll have one. We'll be nimble. And it's a word that makes me laugh, because it's a word that I hear now all the time. Everybody's being nimble, and I'm the last person who could ever call myself nimble. I mean, everybody I know is wearing a boot because they're having osteoporosis, or they're having spurs in their ankles. And not just me or people I know, but everywhere I go, you know, you go to a meeting and a quarter of the people are wearing boots. Nimble? No. Like to be? Yes. But factually? No. And words like nuanced, as remember, I have an allergy to that word, nuanced, or oh, hey, it's complicated, which is always covers over something that is negative. Or I'm, you know, we're all also frustrated. We're frustrated, 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 because the word anger seems to have been canceled. You cannot say angry anymore, but you can say frustrated. So frustrated has become a universal word for something else. And there are many examples, or, you know, I've talked about leaf blowers or tapas or whatever you want to say. You have your own. But not nimble. This is what I mean to say. The church does not need to be nimble. The church needs to preach the gospel of God's grace, the gospel of God's grace in an historical individual who we believe was the absolute incarnation of divine and eternal and enduring mercy, empathy, compassion, and absolute forgiveness, unconditional one-way love. That is the reality. And when an individual parish priest, minister, person, layperson, evangelist, regular guy, regular this, that, or the other thing, conveys that message to someone who is in pain, and everyone is in some form, I would say, maybe let's say almost everyone, most of the time is in some form of subjective, felt, perceptual pain. Instantly, you don't have to be nimble. There is an instant connection. Because connection between two people based upon real, heartfelt, compassionate, empathetic love is a universal gift that immediately contains within itself the seed and the hermeneutic of responsive love and responsive giving and responsive compassion. Years ago, someone who I came to love, a very, the world would have said, sophisticated, affluent, a widow who had married a successful man the second time round, and I believe she'd probably, not probably, it's long gone, it's history of 60 years ago, had left her husband, as had the man she married left his wife to marry, and it was a love match, and we can say what we want, but they were deeply in love, and they had this great, they both had children from their first spouses, and they met and married, and not so long after this love match, based upon a dramatic encounter in the suburbs of an American city, the man died. And the woman, who was not a churchgoer at all, she was, I would have said she was probably had originally grown up in the Episcopal Church or maybe the Congregational Church up north or something like that. And for some reason, she came to a sermon or came to a talk or heard something in the very worst moment of her grief. She was so upset that she would go upstairs into the attic of this very lovely house, and she would be going through boxes of his old letters and things that were of his, and she would lie on the floor, pounding the floor with her elbows, weeping constantly, like Antigone in a tragedy. It was really extraordinarily dramatic, and the entire community, her friends who loved her and knew her, said she's suicidal. This is the end. And for some reason, we talked, and I went over to her house, and she told me the real story. She didn't hide the feeling she had, and she was converted. I mean, she heard the word of compassion and empathy from God, not from man, but from God to her, and she was utterly and completely converted, and I don't think she ever missed church. I mean, she may have been on, you know, in her house in Maine in the summer, but I think church became more important. It was God meeting her at the point of need, and we didn't need to be nimble to meet the potential needs of the communities around us to which we had hitherto not spoken. We needed the gospel and a listening ear, and that created an overwhelming response. So I'm not at all worried about the future of the Christian church in light of that and many other experiences like it. Now, I want to, because the depth of what's really happening with people is met by the depth of what the mockingbird approach, which is simply a reaffirmation of the heart root, the origin and the anchor, the core of God's word to the human race, which is not that we loved God, but that he loved us and gave his son to be a sacrifice for our sins, Jesus Christ the righteous. And you don't have to be overly religious, nor do you have to be unabashedly irreligious. It is a message of, it's not a horizontal message, but it creates horizontal belovedness. This woman never missed, and she had a Bible study in her house, and she opened up, and all her friends were kind of, what? And she brought her friends, and before we knew it, we had a whole cadre of her lovely, but hitherto unchurched friends. and relations. Isn't that wonderful? But that's what happens because the heart of it. Now, I wanted to say something more about this because I... when you get to the core of where people really are, you don't have to worry about being nimble or being have your antennae out. Well, you have to have that emotionally. You have to have your antennae out, but you may miss where it's really going on. The very people that you think should be, you should be reaching out to, you, the people that you think are the targets of your ministry, may not be the targets of your ministry. And the people that end up becoming the targets of your ministry are quite different from what you thought, because it's not about anything rational. It's about the heart being touched by the God that is greater than our hearts, which often condemn us, but not God. Now, I want to mention one other thing. I'm always looking for Christian tokens or Christian emanations or Christian possibilities in literature and popular art, obviously in Paul McCartney, but also in higher art as well. And so for many years, and like Mockingbird does this, we look for analogies to grace, analogies to divine empathy in secular work, and we sometimes find it. But we often find it in places where it's sort of like the crumbs from the master's table, because you may find that in an author or an artist who really wasn't a Christian at all, but at some moment grasped the core of it. I mean, Baroness Blixen, a.k.a. Isaac Dennison, would be out of Africa. You know, she would be an example of this. She was really quite antagonistic to the Christianity, the Protestant Lutheran Christianity, which she had grown up in. She was antagonistic to it. But in her wonderful story, Babette's Feast, she contrasted the reality of real grace to sinners, that is to say, people who have unresolved self-destructive episodes from their past, who really encounter the real grace of God and what it works. But as your member, she's also at pains to attack sort of regular parish Christianity, which she regards as self-righteous and hypocritical. But that's a powerful moment. But she herself wasn't really very friendly. I don't think she went to church at all. And she probably died very much on the agnostic, not an atheist, but very much on the agnostic side. Now, Noel Coward is a very interesting character. He was an agnostic. He wrote a poem, actually, that I quoted once about whether he believes in God or not. And he wrote sophisticated sort of drawing room comedies that are very clever and in some ways very perceptive about men and women and about all sorts of issues in people's lives. In England in the 20s and 30s, he wrote, Cavalcade? He wrote Blythe Spirit, Private Lives, many, many. And he became very, very successful and in Hollywood as well. But his he wrote one play. It's entitled Post Mortem, came out in 1931, that was so bitter and so unlike anything else he'd written, which were mostly fairly upbeat, ironic, as I say, sort of drawing room comedies of upper class twits, as he might have said, male and female. He wrote an extraordinarily vitriolic, bitter, and blasphemous nihilistic attack on English self-identity. After World War I, he felt that the experience of World War I was both a kind of a fruit of a kind of nationalistic Christianity, as he understood it. And that's not true. It's true in a couple cases, but it was not a case of Christian nationalism. And to the extent that it was in some ways a optimistic thing, because it attacked atrocities as it regarded them in Belgium. But take that aside, it's a total attack on British self-understanding, but much more than that, it is an attack on any kind of belief in any kind of real positive meaning. It is an utterly nihilistic work in which the ghost of a young aristocratic officer who's been killed in the trenches in 1917 returns in the year 1930 to see sort of what those who survived it, his fellow officers, his fellow soldiers in the trenches, his disconsolate mother, his very successful, opportunistic, wealthy father, his fiance that he had, his friends. He goes and visits them, and he's a ghost, but he's real. And the ultimate denouement of the play is unbelievably bitter and unbelievably hostile to any kind of meaning whatsoever, whether Christian or not, secular or not. But he does have, in scene two of an 8-scene play, he has an extraordinarily insightful paragraph about really where people really are and why it's not about nimble, it's about empathy, listening, understanding to the real issue of human experience, which is loss, pain, rejection, sorrow, disappointment, bitterness. Not every day. A lot of good things happen in people's lives, but you would be surprised. You probably wouldn't be if you're at a certain stage of life. You might not be surprised at the number of people who are deeply upset about something that happened or didn't happen at an earlier point in their lives. Now, in this particular scene, the ghost of a man named John Cavan has returned to visit his mother, and she realizes it is his ghost, and she talks to him as a man who's been dead for 13 years. It's a supernatural, bitter, nihilistic story. But here's something that really shot out at me as I read this quite brilliant, but deeply, let's just call it nihilistic. Let's just commit suicide if we read it. But Lady Cavan holds on to her son imploringly as he is going to leave. He's going to depart now and visit other people whom he knew before he was killed many years before. And she says to her son, "Listen to me, John. Johnny, my darling, look at me. There's only one thing in the world worth finding, worth catching hold of, if only for a moment. And that's here in this room, between you and me." Let me read that again. Lady Cavan, the mother who loves your son, not in an Oedipal way, in a very lovely, marvelous way, and her son loves her in a very true and adult manner, but real. "Listen to me, John. Johnny, my darling, look at me. There's only one thing in the world worth finding, worth catching hold of, if only for a moment, and that's here in this room, between you and me." Now, what that is saying is that there is only one thing in the world, and that is the connection of love between two individuals. Now, it may be man and wife. It may be boyfriend and girlfriend. It might be brother and sister. It could be mother and son, father and daughter, father and son, mother and daughter, sister and sister, friend and friend. I'm not going to limit it. But there's one thing in the world, and it's very rare, and when it happens, it's everything. Notice she doesn't say it's one of many. It's not both and. It's either or. There's one thing in the world, and it's here right now, even if only for a few minutes, in this room. And that's really the essence of that which the Christian gospel conveys. It conveys the connection of the heart of God with the heart of an individual in pain, similar to when, very rarely, a human being truly connects with the real heart of another human being and vice versa. That is the beginning and the end of all human happiness. When I say the end, I don't mean that. I mean that it is both the beginning and the fulfillment of all human happiness, and it is the seed from which all the trees, as Christ said, of human love and service grow. And it is absolutely unique, personal, direct, and occasional, and sometimes almost never happens. And that's why we don't need to be nimble, because it's there in everybody. I don't need to sort of watch for it. It'll come to me. I'll see it. If I have the eyes to see it, I'll see it in the person I'm sitting next to in the train. I'll see it at someone I might meet, be sitting next to at a Mockingbird conference. I'll see it in someone whom I really love and know very well, but who hasn't talked to me for a long time. And I suddenly see, oh my gosh, that person is in a terrible, terrible spot. Let me listen to what they have to say. Doesn't mean comment. Let me just listen, but let me be God to them. Let me be Christ, I should say. Let me be Jesus Christ to them. That is the heart of what it is. So Coward, who's not a Christian, as I said, he was an atheist, but perhaps a little bit to the right, more like an atheist, between atheist and agnostic. I would probably call him an agnostic. And one of a movie that he starred in called The Scoundrel in 1934-35 is Christian as a movie as you'll ever find. It was written by Ben Hecht, the secular Jew, and Charlie MacArthur, who didn't he live in north of New York? This is the core of the human problem, for which you do not to be nimble, and we can see it in all sorts of art, whether it's Little Nell and Charles Dickens, or whether it's Lady Cavan in Postmortem, or whether it's in Babette's Feast, or whether it's in the New Testament, 1 John. It's in life, and it's for us, and it's for you, and it's not horizontal. It has a horizontal expression, But that is always the expression of God's love. And people see it when they really see that their pain is not discounted, but is taken seriously with tremendous love and empathy. That's my talk about the verticality and the universality and the absolute probity and perspicuity and penetration of real, compassionate, merciful, one-way Christian love. Now we'll hear from our friend again. Love you.
I will always be